Amateur Traveler, episode 837. Today, Amateur Traveler talks about twin towers and trade routes, tea plantations and sacred caves, sultans and the Baba Nonya culture, as we go to Kuala Lumpur and Malaysia. I'm Chris Christensen from Amateur Traveler. Let's talk about Malaysia.
I'd like to welcome to the show Sherizal Abdul Wahid, the Director of Concierge of the Majestic Hotel in Kuala Lumpur, who has come to talk to us about Malaysia. Sherizal, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here today. Thank you.
And I'm going to ask an obvious question, which is, what is your connection with Malaysia?
I'm born and bred in Kuala Lumpur, the capital city of Malaysia itself. Yeah, I guess I'm a local, and I'm very happy to share what the country has to offer.
And obviously, as a director of concierge, you spend a lot of time with tourists, telling them things to do and things to see. So thanks for joining us today. Why should someone go to Malaysia?
I would say for first-timers to Asia, Malaysia would be the best place to experience the region, as you get to experience a multitude of culture, culinary, language and traditions. It goes in line with the Tourism Malaysia's tagline, Malaysia Truly Asia.
I did not know that that was their tagline. Excellent. What kind of itinerary are you going to recommend for us?
For a visit to Malaysia, I would recommend a week stay. There's a lot to offer in Malaysia. So I would actually recommend to break your stays, meaning you stay 2 days in the city, 2 days on an island, and perhaps 2 nights in Borneo.
Okay.
Yeah, because again, as it says, we have almost everything here. We have the tropical forests, we have the highlands, we have the islands and so forth, and even the cities to explore. So there's a lot to see.
Okay. You mentioned starting in the city, so why don't we start there? Are we starting in Kuala Lumpur as a city?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And what are we going to do in Kuala Lumpur?
For Kuala Lumpur, we have both the modern site and also the heritage site, Chris. So if you're into the busyness of the city, the buzz of shopping and everything, and you can stay right in the center of Kuala Lumpur, namely the Bukit Bintang area, or even in the KLCC area, which is where the famous Petronas Twin Towers would be situated.
So that's the city center, is the CC there?
Yes, okay. Kuala Lumpur City Center. And we also have the heritage site, which is the colonial part of the city. Mm-hmm. And that's where my hotel is located, the Majestic Hotel Kuala Lumpur.
Okay.
We have the historical side of the city. We have the museums to visit. We have the old Chinatown. And we have, of course, the...
And I'm going to slow you down here. You say the historic part. So if I'm interested in history and I want to see the historic part, what are a couple of things that I absolutely should see?
Okay. We have the Independence Square, which is the colonial square of Kuala Lumpur. I would say that is where the city began. Kuala Lumpur is actually a very young city, actually. It only started probably in the late 1800s. It came from tin mining, actually. Tin was found not too far away from where the city is today, and that was where the city grew. Like in the Western countries where they have gold rush, we have a tin rush. And at that time, we were colonized by the British, of course. You can actually experience the colonial past of Kuala Lumpur. So in the Independence Square, where the colonial city is, you'll find such buildings such as the Sultan Abdul Samad building, which has been standing there since 1888. And then we have, of course, Chinatown, which used to be the old city area of Kuala Lumpur.
So you mentioned the Sultan Abdul Samad building.
Samad building.
Which is a historic building. Should I go in? Am I just looking at the pretty face of it? Or what am I doing when I go to that building?
No, it's actually a functional building. It's still a functional building till today. But it has... The purpose of the building has changed from time to time, of course. When it was first built, it was actually the administrative offices for the British back then. Today is actually part courthouse and also housing some offices of Tourism Malaysia.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, so it is actually one of the most photographed building in Kuala Lumpur, apart from the Twin Towers, of course.
Right, sure. But in the older part of the city, in the colonial part
In the older part of the city.
Got it.
It's also the focal point for a lot of our celebrations because we have a square where it's located. So, for example, like when we have our Independence Day celebrations, you probably witness the parades and everything passing by the building along the square. So it's a center point for such celebrations too.
Got it. Okay. And you had independence in 1957, is my understanding.
Indeed. Okay, yes. Yes, sir.
And then you said Chinatown. So Chinatown, usually I think of shopping and eating in Chinatown.
Yes.
Is that...
I guess it's the same everywhere.
Okay.
But what's unique about our Chinatown is that it houses a lot of this family-owned business that's generational. Mm-hmm. You'll find restaurants serving age-old recipes there. You'll find vendors making like homemade cakes, tailors, and all those, apart from the night market, of course. So that's a nice place to actually try out our local delicacies.
Okay.
Because the new development of the city itself, you'll probably notice a lot of the old pre-war buildings have actually been refurbished, and a large number of hipster cafes being built within the old buildings and all that. So it's a nice...
And yeah. I'm sure that you can tell that I am, in fact, a big hipster. If I wanted to go to a hipster cafe, where would you send me?
In terms of hipster cafes, it's a bit hard to say now, Chris, because truthfully, there's been quite a number of those cafes that I know of has actually closed down due to the pandemic.
Got it. Well, I guess by the time it becomes hip enough that I shouldn't go there, once I know about it, it's already passé probably at that point anyway.
Most probably, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And then in Chinatown, you mentioned the night market.
The night market, it's one of those markets that's very popular for its knickknacks and all that. And if you're looking for shoes, bags and all that, some are even copy bags and all that. So it's a place where you can test your bargaining skills, I would say. Yeah, just for the fun of it.
Where I can get my Galvin Klein or something like that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
A Rolex that moves the right way with the right spelling.
Got it. All right. And I assume also with a night market, then there'd be food stalls as well? Or is it mostly focusing?
Indeed.
Okay. I've had some of my best meals at night markets sitting on some little plastic stool or whatever. But
yes. Talking about food stalls, there is actually a street, not in Chinatown itself, but it's actually near the main shopping district called Bukit Bintang. This popular street is called Jalan Alor. Jalan in Malay means street. Yeah, so it's called Alor Street. So along this Jalan Alor is actually focusing on just street food. The whole street. Okay. And it's open till 2, 3 a.m. in the morning. So if you're craving for some late night snacks or a late supper or something after your day long of shopping or probably visiting our clubs, that would be a place to go just for some quick snacks and something local.
And if you're having local street food or you're taking a visitor there, two or three dishes that you just got to try.
Oh, I would go for satay. There's also those chicken wings that are very popular there in Jalan Alor itself.
Okay.
And another one would probably be one of those. Surprisingly, you also find some nice Thai restaurants there, Thai stalls there. So perhaps you want to try one of those mango dishes with the glutinous rice.
Oh, okay.
Which makes for a good snack. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Anything else we want to do in the Old Town area?
Another part of the Old Town that is a must visit, I would say, would be the River of Life. Okay. That is where two rivers actually meet and form into one river. So it's actually the Klang River meeting the Gombak River. And at the point where the two rivers meet, this is where they say Kuala Lumpur got its name. Because the word Kuala Lumpur itself means muddy estuary.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you.
Yeah. Right. So imagine back then in the 1800s or probably earlier than that, when the two rivers meet, I'm sure that would have been a very muddy spot. I guess the locals would have called it, let's meet up at Kuala Lumpur. You know, that's a good landmark to meet and everything. And where the two rivers meet, right in the middle of the two rivers, you actually see one of the oldest mosques that is still standing to this very day called the Jamik Mosque. So it's a very beautiful building. Surprisingly, it was designed by a British architect, but it's still standing to this very day. It was actually used as our national mosque until 1965. That was when we had built a new mosque downtown elsewhere. So that particular Jamik Mosque is still standing to this very day. So it makes for a beautiful photo shot, I would say, to say that you're in Kuala Lumpur and with the old minarets, you know, of the mosque, and behind it, you see the tall buildings around it. It's like a big contrast of old and new.
And if someone who is not a Muslim wants to visit the Jamik Mosque, what are the protocols in Malaysia? Is that something that they can do, just need to dress appropriately, take off their shoes, and not disturb the services? Or
exactly. For most of our mosques, we do have visits, especially at the National Mosque, the Jamik Mosque, and the other one called the Wilayah Mosque or the Federal Mosque. They actually have visits to the mosque where they take you around within the mosque on a tour.
Okay.
Of course, you'll have to dress appropriately.
Which means no shoulders, no knees showing.
Yes, no shoulders, no knees showing.
Yep.
And if you're not dressed for it, they actually have ropes where you can actually wear to visit.
Okay. And then do women need to wear a head covering in the mosque or not in Malaysia?
It comes with the rope. The rope they provide is actually has head coverings and everything.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, it's a hood. Yeah, it's like a hoodie.
Okay.
And the visiting times is usually away from the five time prayers.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't need the tourists to be there at the same time as the worshippers. Okay. Got it.
Exactly.
And then you said something about museums. Okay. Is there some place that you recommend people go to understand the area better?
Just 5 minutes from the Majestic Hotel Kuala Lumpur, within the historical mile of the city, we have the National Museum.
Okay.
That gives you an insight of the history of Malaysia itself. And it's compartmentalized into four sections. They have sections 1 to 4, A to D. And in each section, they have the different periods of Malaysia, the development of Malaysia itself, starting from the prehistoric time right up till probably the post-independence.
Got it. Okay.
So,
and that was also very nice good product placement there for the Majestic Hotel. I like how you slipped that in very carefully. Nice job.
Thank you. Another attraction that I'd like to share is actually more of a nature or probably spiritual kind of visit. It's a place called Batu Caves.
Okay.
It's actually a set of limestone caves situated probably about 30 minutes away from the city center.
Okay.
I think it's the third most important Hindu attraction in the world. It's actually a temple placed inside the caves itself.
Mm-hmm.
But to get into the caves, you actually have to climb up some steps.
Some very colorful steps is what I'm seeing.
Some very colorful steps indeed. They call it the rainbow steps.
Okay.
And do you want to guess how many steps? Or have you already seen the answer there?
I don't know. I don't have the answer in front of me.
Do you want to guess?
300.
Close. It's actually 272 steps in total. And it says that with every step that you take climbing the steps, it actually clears a sin.
Okay.
For me, I guess I have to go up a couple of times. Anyway.
Well, it looks like it's in a very beautiful karst landscape, very green.
You can actually venture around the caves itself.
Okay.
And usually a visit into the caves will probably take about an hour or slightly more than an hour, depending on how fast you climb the steps, of course.
Sure.
Yeah.
I wonder how many times you have to do it. Yeah, but that's...
And on a yearly event, we have this festival called the Taipusam Festival.
Okay.
And this is where the Hindu believers actually, they do a sort of like a pilgrimage.
Okay.
Where they carry the chariots and everything and with their offerings from a certain point in Chinatown itself, which has one of the older Hindu temple, and they walk barefoot all the way to Batu Caves.
Oh my, okay.
And they climb up the steps and then they do their offerings there. So it's like a yearly event, and that's something to witness actually.
Hmm, okay. And for someone like me who's heading out there half hour, is that easier to get on a tour or public transportation, or what's the best way for me to get out there?
I'm aware that there are city tours that include Batu Caves into their itinerary.
Okay.
But if you wish to go on your own, it's also possible. It's accessible by taxi. It's only a taxi, about a 30 minutes taxi ride from the city center.
Okay.
And if you bought a train, there's actually a train that goes all the way to Batu Caves. It's probably about 45 minutes train ride from KL Central, which is the main train hub itself.
Okay.
So it's pretty accessible. It's pretty accessible, yeah.
And I'm guessing, my impression is that taxis in KL are not terribly expensive.
No, if you were to hire a taxi using a meter or so, it will probably set you back about 60 ringgit an hour.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's what, probably 10? No.
So it's roughly 4 to 1.
4 to 1, yeah.
Yeah. So that would divide by 4 to get, so $15 an hour. Okay.
Yes, yes. That's, of course, if you run the meter. So it's roughly around that price.
Pre-negotiating, you mean?
To be frank, they're not allowed to negotiate.
Okay.
They're supposed to use the meters. So using taxis in
Kuala Lumpur is all on meter. You say they're supposed to use the meter, and I feel like you're saying that like they may not use the meter, even though they're supposed to use the meter.
Well, I would say they would rogue drivers who tend to be, and I guess it happens in a lot of other cities too. But another way of traveling around the city is also, we have this thing called the hail, you know, hailing service, e-hailing service, yeah. Something like Uber and Lyft. So we do have that too in the city, in Kuala Lumpur. Okay. And that would be slightly cheaper than taking a taxi, of course, but provided that you have the app on your phone.
Okay. And then one thing I'm curious about is, and this always comes up when I'm trying to negotiate with a taxi driver or something like that, is how widespread is English for those of us who are monolingual sort of travelers? Your English is obviously wonderful, and I'm guessing in hotel concierges, I'm going to find very good English. If I just grab a taxi on the street, what are the odds that I'm going to be able to get myself understood if I don't speak Malay?
Generally, Chris, English is our second language here. Mm-hmm. We do learn English in school. So for taxi drivers, I would say, yeah, you'll be okay traveling with, they'll be able to speak English and all that. Yeah, so we're fine with the language, yep.
Okay, good. Anything else we want to see in KL?
Apart from what I mentioned, of course, we have the temples. One thing about Kuala Lumpur, or probably generally Malaysia itself, we're a multicultural people. We have a multi-faith. So, for example, like in Chinatown alone, you'll be surprised. It's called Chinatown. You probably find a Hindu temple there, situated right next door to a Buddhist temple. Mm-hmm. So we have quite a lot of interesting temples for you to visit. One of it will be the Tian Hao Temple, which is about maybe another 10, 15 minutes away from my hotel. It's considered one of the largest Buddhist temple in town. It's very picturesque. And as nowadays with people on Instagram and everything, they call it a very Instagrammable spot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, and then you mentioned the two towers. Recommend taking time to go up in the towers, or is there someplace else that you recommend people go to if they wanted the best sightseeing view of the city?
Okay. Visiting the Twin Towers, yes. Obviously, when you're in town, you want to say, oh, I've gone up the Twin Towers. It's an 88-story building. It's still considered the tallest Twin Towers in the world. Mm-hmm. It was once the tallest building until, I think, Taipei 101 took over. So yes, if you were to visit the Twin Towers, and if you wish to go up, you'll probably go up to the Sky Bridge, which is located either on the 41st or the 42nd floor. And then you will get to visit right up to the 86th floor, which is also like an observation deck as partial of the visit. So it's a 45-minute visit up. The only thing is the tickets. The tickets is not really on a first-come, first-served basis, but they go based on time slots. So per day, they would probably have, for example, if a 12 noon visit, probably they have only 40 tickets available for that particular slot. And out of these 40 tickets, probably a quarter of it will be sold online.
Okay.
And the rest will be over the counter.
So if that's a must-see for me, do I need to book ahead of times online or get there at a certain time of day and get a ticket there? Or how does that work?
If you have a
specific time that you want to... Or talk to my local concierge or...
Oh, that too, of course. Either way, there are three options that you can go. Online would be the best, where you purchase the ticket in advance based on your preferred time. Okay. If you queue, it really depends on what's available on that day itself.
Okay.
So you may be queuing as early as 8 o'clock in the morning, but you may not get to visit till probably 12 noon.
Got it. Okay.
But again, if you go through the concierge, I'm sure they will be able to get you tickets too. But again, it depends on the time of the queue and all that, because usually they will have probably agents or third-party people who actually help to purchase the tickets on their behalf. And it really depends on the availability of the tickets again. Yeah.
And oddly enough, right there is where Sherazal got a call talking to a concierge. That's what happens. And his side stopped recording. So we're going to pick this up and we're going to do a conversation that he and I have already had before, but we're going to share it with you this time. Sherazal, anything else we want to talk about before we leave Kuala Lumpur?
No, I believe I've covered most of it.
Excellent. And then we had talked about going to one of the islands and then going off to Borneo, we ended up talking actually last time about, I think, an even more interesting, more local itinerary. Mm. You were taking me down the coast from Kuala Lumpur.
Oh, yes. I was actually introducing to you a little coastal town called Malacca. It's actually the historical state of Malaysia. So it's known for its history, of course. And I've always likened it to be the nucleus of what Malaysia is today, because it started out from that little trade port along the Straits of Malacca, where you had the silk trade, the spice trade coming in. And then from then on, it grew into what we have today.
And you say the Straits of Malacca, and I think many of our listeners know what you're talking about. But for those who don't, this is, if you look at a map, and I encourage you to open up a map and look at India over here to the west and China over here to the east and north from Malaysia. And if you look at how the ships would go between them, because of the island of Sumatra and this long peninsula of Malaysia, they really go through this narrow strait past Malacca, past Singapore, and then back up the other side. And even today, 30% of all the shipping traffic in the world flows through this narrow Straits of Malacca. But as you say, it really got started as these trading ports here and the Spice Road, and then later on, all of the other trade that happened in this area. So when we go to Malacca, we're going to see buildings not going back 1,000 years, but back to the 1700s and 1800s or so.
Yes, or even earlier, perhaps. Yeah, even earlier, perhaps. I've just returned from a trip from Malacca itself. And being local, going there, you're really in awe of the fact that you're standing in the same street that has been there for ages. And I saw a mosque, one of the first few mosques that was built in Malacca back then, and it was built in 1726. And until today, it's still standing and people are still congregating in that mosque. So it's really unique. It's even more unique, the fact that being a mosque, you always imagine that it has all those domes and everything, but this mosque had a very Chinese look to it because of the influence that it had back in those days.
And this reminded me of a question, which is, I don't know where Islam came to Malaysia from.
I believe, Chris, it would have been from the Arab traders coming in who came in to trade in Malacca, and they spread the good word of Islam. And I guess when the sultans of old converted, that's when it became widespread.
Okay. Interesting. That makes sense. So they've been sailing all along the Indian Ocean, and this is where the Indian Ocean ends, as it were.
True. Excellent. Yeah.
Malacca, I see, is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So
it is.
This is a special town, and you're not the only one who thinks so.
It's a small town. It's a small state, actually. And the town center itself, you don't really have to drive around. You can just walk about the whole city just to experience it. And it's funny because at one section, you'll probably find yourself in the Dutch area of Malacca with the old buildings built during the Dutch era. And then you'll find the old forts of the Portuguese forts, especially the Formosa Fort, which was built back then to actually protect the whole Malacca from being invaded by, again, the Dutch and also the British, who was trying to take over the whole state.
And did eventually.
It did eventually, yeah. And then you'll also see the mixture of culture cultivated into what we have, a little community. Like today we have what we call the Baba and Nyonya, or the Peranakan community, who was actually a result of a mix of culture between the Chinese coming into trade and the locals, where they adapted a whole new kind of culture altogether.
So the Peranakan, or Straits Chinese, people who came in as shopkeepers and traders and settled in and intermarried and such. Mm. And stop me if I'm wrong, Baba and Nyonya is like grandmother and grandfather?
No. It's actually a term. If you come to the meaning, it actually means Mr. and Nyonya means ma'am or something like that. But because of that culture itself, they are known as Baba Nyonya because they're practically Chinese, but they assimilate the Malay culture. They wear traditional wear that is worn by mostly Malays, actually. They speak Malay, and their food, the culinary that comes from this community, is actually a fusion of Malay and Chinese. It's unique.
Okay. I know if I'm in Singapore, for instance, I can go to the Peranakan Museum and learn more about that. If I'm in Malacca, is there a particular way that I can approach and learn more about that culture?
Oh, yes. I understand they do have the Peranakan Museum in Melaka itself.
Oh, okay.
And there's also a street which is known for its Baba Nyonya heritage. The actual street was actually known as the Millionaire's Row back in those days, because that was where the rich Baba Nyonyas, they built their homes there and everything, and they were running their businesses there too. And so these homes have been preserved, and some of them have turned into hotels, some of them have turned into restaurants, some just preserved as a home, a private home. So you can still see the aspects of the Baba Nyonya touch here and there. The building itself is beautifully decorated and everything. The tiles of the floorings are just so typically Malaccan, I would say.
Okay. This is so funny doing this conversation again. So I was picturing Phuket. That when you describe this, that we're talking about the shop houses like I saw up in Phuket, which is here also on this street, these really deep houses with the shop on the bottom floor and the people living on the top floor and in the back. And
Indeed. Talking about Melaka and talking about these houses, I'd just like to share that we also have a property in Melaka, Chris. It's called the Majestic Hotel Melaka. It was an old Chinese tycoon's home that was actually transformed into a hotel. So that's also located right in the heart of Melaka itself, within walking distance to most of the attractions.
Now, is that the same name? Is that a Majestic Hotel also? Is that the brand?
I wouldn't say it's like a brand. It's just that we call it the Majestic too. So we have the Majestic Hotel Kuala Lumpur. But Majestic Hotel Kuala Lumpur is actually under the Marriott Group.
Oh, got it. I did not
know that. So we're an autograph collection, whereas Majestic, it's not under the Marriott. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Then anything else we can do while we're in Melaka? Anything we ought to see, learn, eat?
Of course, when you're in Melaka, you have to try the Peranakan food, of course. That would be something that you definitely have to try. It could be a bit spicy at times, but if you're okay with spice, then it's fine. But there are some restaurants that actually can cater to the foreign tongue, I would say. And of course,
you're saying they make it more boring, is really what you're saying.
Less spicy.
Less spicy.
Less spicy.
Okay.
Less spicy, yes. And then there's also the Portuguese influence of the dishes there. Apart from dining, just to walk about in the whole old part of town is just a wonder. As you said, it's a heritage city. It's just eye candy. It's just eye candy. It's photographs everywhere, temples here and there, and just the little details that they have on the buildings that they preserve is something worth looking at.
And again, that you have to be mixed there to streets culture of here's the mosque, here's the temple, here's the other temple, but now we're talking Buddhist temple or something like that, I'm assuming.
Yes, okay. Yes. And there's also a river that runs through the town itself. They do have river cruises that you can take. There's a small river that runs through the town with alfresco cafes lining along the sides. After a long walk around town, it's just nice to sit back and just enjoy probably a glass of beer or probably a cup of coffee just to watch the day go by.
And you said Malacca is Malaysia. Mm-hmm. Historically or also the current Malaysia?
In terms of historically, yes, because that was one of the earlier settlements and it was one of the earlier ports that was actually taken over from being colonized and all that. I'm not sure if you're aware, but in Malaysia, in total, we have about 13 states all over Malaysia. Mm-hmm. But out of these 13 states, we have 9 states that are monarchy. How do you call that? Sultans?
Okay.
Yeah. So we have 9 sultans that have 9 states in Malaysia. And they take turns to become the king every 5 years.
I did not know that. Okay.
But, yeah. So these sultans, their lineage comes from Melaka, actually.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yes. And not all of them, of course, but the majority of them, the lineage actually comes from Melaka. Oh. But because of the history of Melaka itself, it's funny that today there is no sultan in Melaka.
Huh. Okay.
So due to the course of history, with all the colonization and everything, somehow the sultan in Melaka, who was one of the earlier sultanates or whatever in back then, ran away and formed another state and all that. So what we have today is actually a lineage from a bit from Melaka. So it's quite unique in that sense.
Interesting. No, I did not know that. Thank you. That helps me understand things a little better. Anything else we should do in Melaka before we move on to, we've got one more place that we wanted to cover here.
Nah, I can't think of anything else.
Okay. And then the other question that I asked was, if I wanted to go out and see more of nature without getting on a plane and flying to Borneo, for instance, which is going to be fascinating. We've done shows on that. Or going all the way north, where would you take me? And you took me into the interior.
Oh, yes. There is this highlands in between, not too far away from Kuala Lumpur. It's about a 3 hours drive. It's called the Cameron Highlands. Mm-hmm. So it's a winding road to go up there. But along the way, once you've exited the highway and everything, you'll probably notice it's full of, it's just nature all the way. You'll even pass by a few waterfalls. And you'll know you've reached Cameron Highlands once you see all the tea plantations, the hills filled up with those tea leaves and everything. And it's really a sight to see. Yeah.
You said about a 3 hour drive.
Yeah, it's approximately a 3 hour drive from the city center.
And then I'm going to find myself in lush green rolling hills. And it's going to be cooler.
Yes, of course, there'll be a small town on top. Yeah, of course, there'll be a small town and all that. But yeah, but the lush green hilltops will be a real nice getaway from the hustle bustle of the city and everything. It is indeed cooler up there. Generally, Malaysia is about 28 to 32 degrees Celsius again. But up there will probably be about an average about, 20? It could go down to maybe 12.
Okay. And 12 is about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. 28 is about 82. So north of 82 is what the temperatures I should expect. And humid. Okay.
So it's a nice getaway for city folks, of course. It used to be back then in the colonial days of the British, that would be the place where they would go for Christmas and everything, just to get away from the heat, to feel a bit at home.
And it, 3 hours seems like I could do it as a day trip, but that seems like a lot of driving. So probably better to spend the night someplace, any place you recommend up there. I'm going to
again. We would have our own property there.
Why, what a surprise.
We have the Cameron Highlands Resort, which is located in Cameron Highlands itself. It's a property facing a golf course, actually. If you do stay there, take advantage of the tours. They do provide like a hiking tour around the highlands where you get a taste of a bit of the nature. I think it's about a 45 minutes to an hour hike or so with the tour.
You say the nature, I'm picturing tea plantations, I think you mentioned earlier, waterfalls, also wildlife?
You probably see one or two, but because of the development there, I think they've really went further away from where people are. But in terms of nature, yes, there's plenty to see. There's even a strawberry farm that you can visit up there. So it's very popular for its strawberries, actually.
And strawberries took me by surprise because with the tropics there, I wasn't expecting that.
I can't imagine. But it's really sweet. The strawberries there is really sweet. Actually, Cameron Highlands is also very popular for its agricultural aspect of it. A lot of our vegetables that we have comes from Cameron Highlands itself.
Okay.
So, so that's also another area for plant cultivation and everything. So,
got it. And is it the same direction as the Batu Caves? Would it make sense to do that, like maybe Batu Caves on the way up to the highlands?
It is possible. You can actually do a day trip to Cameron Highlands, but because of the traveling time, I would probably keep Batu Caves on the side. You can if you really want to, but it will take up a bit of your traveling time because it's a 2 hours visit in Batu Caves itself before you head up to Cameron Highlands.
Okay.
I've had guests doing that before, They just want to cover a lot of things in one go.
Okay. Any other spots to really connect with nature near the KL area?
Batu Caves is also a nature spot. I mentioned that earlier. We have a few pockets of reserve forests within the city itself. You'll be surprised that we have a little pocket of forest where you can do a little bit of jungle trekking in the heart of town itself.
I would be surprised. What is that called?
It's okay. There are two places, actually. One would be called the Tugu Trail. It's near where the national monuments are located. It's called Tugu, as in T-U-G-U. Tugu Trail. It's a 45-minute trail.
Got it.
And another one would be called the Kuala Lumpur Eco Park, which is at the base of the KL Tower, the single tower, the communication tower of Kuala Lumpur.
We didn't talk about the other tall tower.
Yes. And then we also have about 20 minutes out from the city, we have the Forest Reserve Institute of Malaysia, which is area dedicated to research on our forestry. So that's another place that you can actually enjoy Nietzsche.
Okay.
F-R-I-M.
And then I think you mentioned when we recorded this the first time, the Mossy Forest as another thing to do up by the Cameron Highlands.
Yes. The Mossy Forest is another attraction in Cameron Highlands itself, yeah. But I would recommend to go there with a tour, with a guide.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Excellent. Is there anything else that people need to know before they book their trip to Malaysia?
Coming to Malaysia, you have to be prepared for the weather. Fat gusts coming in and saying that, wow, the moment they stepped up the airport and it's, whoa, a big whoosh of heat coming to their face. Be prepared to try our food. If you're not keen on spicy, be adventurous. Try it out. That's how we are here. Food is our most favorite thing to have.
If somebody wants to have something authentic, they don't want to go to that place that's going to dumb it down for the Westerners, but they're still not a fan of spicy, is there a good dish that they can have that's authentic but not spicy?
You can try what we call this char kway teow.
Okay.
It's actually flat noodles, fried flat noodles, wok style, fried in the wok. You can have it non-spicy too, but that is also quite Malaysian, I would say. It's a simple dish, but it's also very Malaysian. Another thing, this is what I get from guests coming to the desk. Occasionally, they'll come up to me and say, Sharizal, will it be okay if I were to wear shorts going around the city? I said, of course. Kuala Lumpur is just like any other city. It is hot, so it's of course, it's understandable that you like to wear your shorts and everything. But of course, there will be some places that probably will impose some dress codes. For example, if you're visiting a mosque or if you're going fine dining and all that. But apart from that, it should be okay.
And I'm guessing one of the reasons they ask is they see a lot of locals, even though it's hot, who are wearing long pants.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And there's also the impression that because Malaysia, its official religion would be Islam. Probably that too, but it's okay. No problem. Even on weekends, I wear shorts anyway.
Okay. And as we go to wrap this up, you're standing in the prettiest spot in this little region around Kuala Lumpur of Malaysia.
Oh, yes.
That we've been talking about.
Oh, yes.
Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
I am, from where I'm standing, I'm actually in the hotel now. We're actually located right in front of the historical mall of the city. So right across the street from the hotel, I actually see the old train station, the Kuala Lumpur station, with its Mughal architecture and minarets. We're also about 10 minutes walking distance to Chinatown. And if from the left, to the left of the hotel, about 20 minutes, you reach the colonial district that I mentioned earlier, which is Independence Square.
Botanical gardens are just behind me here, right?
Correct. Yes, just behind the hotel is the botanical gardens. It's just around the corner. It's an award-winning botanical gardens with a beautiful lake in the middle where you can actually walk about. So in the botanical gardens, we have the Kuala Lumpur Bird Park, which is one of the biggest walk-in aviary. We have a deer park, which you can visit. And yeah, and that beautiful lake, it's actually a man-made lake that was done in the 1800s as a gift to the British resident's wife. And now it's an attraction, I would say. In the evenings, when I have the time, I'll actually jog around the lake, and it only takes about 45 minutes or so just to cover the whole lake.
And if you had to summarize Kuala Lumpur and the region in just three words, what three words would you use?
I would go with the Tourism Malaysia's tagline again, Malaysia truly Asia, Chris. You'll find everything here.
Now, the last time we tried this, I asked you as a concierge, as having spent a number of years as a concierge, what was the most interesting request that you had. Could you tell that story again that you told me?
Sure. This happened quite a few years ago. I had a long stay guest, Chris, and he was staying with us for about a week or so. And based on his request, I noticed that he was visiting all the older parts of the country, namely Penang, Ipoh. And after much conversation with him, I finally found out that he was actually an ex-British Army who was stationed here back in World War II. On his last day, about after breakfast, I had a chat with him. Said I was asking him how was his stay. Hope he had a good time and everything. And he said, "Oh, Sharizal, I had a wonderful stay, and you've helped me with everything. And I get to reminisce the old days while I was here in the army." Then I asked, "Is there anything else that probably I can help you with?" Then he said, I have one thing actually, but I'm not sure whether you can help me. I said, sure, let me try. I'm actually looking for an old friend of mine. So I said, okay, is he still living here? Probably I can find his address. If you can give me his name, his last known address. And he laughed. And he just said, I don't think so, Sherizal, because my friend actually passed away during the war. And I've never got to visit his grave. So I said, oh, okay. So let me see what I can do. So I know his flight was about 10 p.m. that day. With the name that he gave me, I took the time to make a few phone calls. And I eventually did find out where his friend was buried. He was actually buried in one of the old Commonwealth graveyards, which is in town, not too far away. So at 6 o'clock, he got on a taxi. I gave him the address. On the way to the airport, he dropped by the address that I gave him. And a week later, he sent me an email with a picture of him by the gravestone and said, thank you so much. I found my old friend again.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Sherizal Abdul Wahid.
Yes, sir.
And you know, I didn't catch, do you work at a hotel, Sherizal?
Yes, I am actually the concierge of the Majestic Hotel Kuala Lumpur, Chris.
Excellent. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on, Amateur Traveler. Thank you for dealing with some technical issues we had when the advantage of doing this on Sherizal's phone was we got better audio quality. The disadvantage is he gets calls. So thank you for sharing with us your love for your country of Malaysia.
My pleasure again, Chris. And thank you for having me. And I do look forward to see your guests or your listeners visiting Malaysia very soon.
I did want to give a special thanks to Sherizal, who for putting up with some of the problems we had with the having to re-record things. That's always a bit of a hassle. I learned a little bit about the concierge industry or the business of being a concierge through him. He's a member of Le Clef d'Or, the Golden Keys, which is a professional affiliation accolade that he has, which he didn't mention during this show, but that's interesting to hear more about that as well. I also want to set out a special thanks to the patrons of the show who help support Amateur Traveler financially. If you're interested in becoming a patron of the show, you can go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler. Remember that we are in the process of putting together the 2023 trip in September to Japan and the 2024 trip to probably northern Morocco in late April. So if you're interested in learning more about those, go to amateurtraveler.com/trips. I had an email from Simon, who talked about Turkey and who said, how timely your edition on Turkey this week. So talking about the Turkey episode we did on the Black Sea was after the devastation of the earthquake that hit the south of the country just a day after we broadcast the show. I really enjoyed your guest, Kimberly, whose stories brought back memories of our trip to the eastern part of the country almost 10 years ago. The Süleymaniye Monastery is indeed an extraordinary ancient place, and the tea plantations of Riza are just vast and beautiful to look at. The one thing we didn't do, but would on a future visit, is go to a football soccer game. That was a big match on when we were in Trebizond, and the atmosphere in the streets was electrifying as the local rivalry with the big Istanbul team gets the whole city excited. Can I also give a shout out to long-distance bus travel in Turkey? We found the Greyhound-style coaches to be top quality, with the tea served on board and the stops at highway services surprising us with culinary delights, like homemade soups and lentil bakes. It takes a little longer than flying, but helped us to connect with how the locals travel. Finally, I wish I'd known about the Turkish rice pudding your guest mentioned. That sounds like a must for our next trip to Turkey. Keep up your great work on the podcast, Simon. And I wrote back to Simon, and I appreciated him writing, and I'm hoping there was no connection between us doing a show on Turkey and the earthquake around Gaziantep, Turkey, more than a few hundred miles away from where we were talking about. I do have a connection, though, to Gaziantep. I have been to Gaziantep, Turkey, so it was heartrending to see some of the devastation there. We had a Turkish exchange student from Gaziantep who still lives in the region. He is okay. His family is safe, but he said it was a terrifying experience. And when the first numbers came in of 5,000 buildings collapsing, I knew that the death toll would be higher because the city was predominantly, I would say, five-story tall apartment buildings. And so clearly with this earthquake hitting in the middle of the night and so many buildings collapsing, that was going to be a great loss of life, as we have seen as those numbers have developed. My heart goes out to Yavuz Çalyan and to the people of Gaziantep, Turkey. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more.